This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Heather Claiborne, in this week for George Levesque. That sound is as much of a holiday tradition as hanging stockings and Christmas cookies. Every year, dozens of volunteers across the big country collect change and dollars in red kettles as shoppers head in and out of stores. KACU reporters Bailey Simon and Leslie Kerrigan spoke with some of the bell ringers in Abilene.
Jesus Lozano was a bell ringer in 2002 and 2003 and decided to volunteer again this year. This week, he was ringing the bell next to the red kettle outside of United Supermarkets.
Mothers of single moms, or if you don't got food or shelter, they help them all.
The Salvation Army estimates that at one point, 25,000 bell ringers were on the nation's streets collecting funds for the programs, and like Lozano, wishing shoppers a Merry Christmas.
Just to help them out, volunteer to help them. That way, I'll have my part.
Captain Joseph McPhee started the Salvation Army's Red Kettle campaign in 1891. McPhee was a Salvation Army officer looking for a way to cover the cost of the community Christmas meal. The tradition continues today. The donations made during Christmas time go towards providing meals, gifts, and winter gear for families in need. And they contribute to several initiatives all year long, including providing shelter for the homeless and addiction rehabilitation centers. James Pistol rang a bell this week outside of the Mall of Abilene.
I give everything to Jesus, you know. But I know Jesus look out for me, you know. That's just my beliefs, you know. Everybody don't have the same beliefs, but, you know. And I know this doesn't pay very much either, but I'm disabled and everything. Both my legs have been broke twice, and I'm missing my right arm. So I got to make a little bit of money.
Pistol points to the words of the Bible that encourage generosity and kindness as part of his motivation to be part of the campaign. The Salvation Army is an evangelical part of the Universal Christian Church. Their mission is to preach the gospel of Jesus Christ and to meet human needs in His name without discrimination. Outside the Walmart Supercenter, Billy Finch echoed some of the sentiments shared by the other bell ringers, saying that the Spirit of God motivates him and gives him the duty to be a bell ringer.
It's not about helping people, it's my relationship with God. It's about the hope of everlasting life. And this Christmas, we clang a bell for Santa Claus and raise money for the poor and for the homeless, but it's all about Jesus. We're trying to do what He did.
Finch says he wants to help those struggling because he was once dependent on the Salvation Army too. Being a red kettle bell ringer is his way of giving back.
I don't stay there now, but over the years, in my drug addiction, in my life of living and drinking and carousing, I've lived there two or three different times, and they saved my life on them cold winter nights.
Appreciation for the Salvation Army's provision is something the bell ringers share. Standing outside the Sam's Club, Brad Hines says he too sees this as an opportunity to repay some of the kindness and support he's received.
I lived with the Salvation Army twice to help people out.
Hines says people are very generous and that he and another worker have raised a significant amount of funds to make a difference for the Salvation Army and those they serve. This is Bailey Simon with the reporting help of Leslie Kerrigan in Abilene.
Andre Gwynn is the development manager with the Salvation Army of Abilene, and he's here to talk about those bell ringers with us. Thank you so much for coming in.
Absolutely. Thank you for the invite.
How's it going this year?
It's actually going great. We've had a large response from our community for volunteer bell ringers. They've been doing a very active and very great job for us at those bells at Sam's and at Hobby Lobby. All the Walmarts, United Supermarkets, and Market Street are the locations that we're bell ringing at this year. Oh, and also the Mall of Abilene. And we've had people agencies and groups like Rotary Club has come out and rang the bell for us. FCA has come out and rang the bell for us, as well as just our regular just volunteers who have come out with their families and kiddos and softball teams, ACU's softball team came out. And it's fantastic to see that community support for just volunteering for the Salvation Army during the holiday season.
Yeah, this is a time of year that more people look for opportunities to give back to the community, and this is a great time. But not everybody can make it out to volunteer. Not everybody has cash in their pockets these days for the Red Kettles. But there's an opportunity for the folks that maybe want to give and haven't been able to, right?
Yes, absolutely. So you can always go online, salvationarmy.org/Abilene. You want to make sure you're going to the Abilene site if you want to donate to the Abilene Corps. But if you walk up to our bell ringers, they'll have QR codes that you can scan that'll take you directly to our site as well. You can also donate to our virtual kettle, which can be found at registertoring.com. It'll be the third option that says, I would like to virtually ring, and it will reroute you to a link that will allow you to donate online as well to our cause.
So when you guys collect the funds from these Red Kettles, how are you able to distribute those in the community? What are you able to do with those funds that are donated?
So those funds that are donated goes directly to our community here in the city of Abilene, and primarily to our neighbors experiencing homelessness throughout the city of Abilene. Those donations provide meals, hygiene kits. They provide clothing, jackets, blankets, especially for this time of season where temperatures are dropping below 40, 45, which actually activates our warming centers here throughout Abilene. So those donations go directly to helping those hidden ones, the ones we don't see every day that sleep in encampments out on the outskirts of Abilene or under bridges that are in dire need of just a little bit of comfort and safety when it comes to these winter seasons.
What's your goal for the year? I know, you know, every year you've got a certain amount that you're trying to reach. Is there a greater need? Is there a higher goal?
There's always a greater need. Unfortunately, homelessness and low-income, poverty-level-stricken families is something that is growing. It's not something that's slowing down. There have been changes that have occurred throughout the year when it comes to SNAP benefits, food stamps, that has put families in dire straits when it comes to feeding their kids or feeding themselves. Even though they have those resources back, it's kind of put them behind a little bit because they've had to do things like maybe pawn something or sell something to be able to put food on the table. So now they're playing catch up. That's where the Salvation Army of Abilene steps in and providing breakfast, lunch, and dinner for our community. We are the only emergency shelter in the city of Abilene. So it's a huge responsibility and it's a huge endeavor for us to take. But we appreciate that the community of Abilene supports us with that, and they come alongside us, whether it be donations or volunteers. They help us a lot when it comes to helping our community.
And when it gets cold like this, are you pretty full?
Yes. When it drops below 45 degrees consistently for 3 hours, our shelter is open to the public because we don't want people to be out in the cold, freezing, hypothermia, any of those type of things that occur when we have such frigid temperatures. So, yes, there's people that have homes and their heater is not, you know, producing enough heat, so they get cold. We have surprisingly a number of elderly people that have to take refuge in our shelter during the winter season as well.
One of the other things that you do this season is the angel tree. And as I remember seeing this week that you still have angels that are waiting to be claimed. Tell us a little bit about that right now.
Angel Tree is an opportunity for just regular citizens of the city of Abilene to be superheroes for kiddos that wake up Christmas morning and deserve to have a Christmas like every other child here in the city of Abilene. Those Angel Tree tags are at our Walmart locations, as well as Angel Tree in the Mall of Abilene in front of Hot Topic, next to their Christmas display where Santa is. And we really appreciate people who have the heart and the capacity to come out and adopt those kids, provide them clothes, or electronics or toys or anything that gives that child a sense of normalcy in the sense that they don't live a different life than any other child here in the city of Abilene does. So we have around 100 Angel Tree tags still out in circulation. ACU has a Angel Tree here as well at the Moody Coliseum, mm-hmm. I believe. So, there's Angel Tree tags to be had that will go a long way to make sure a kid here in the city of Abilene and some of our outer lying areas as well have a Christmas that they deserve to have.
So what is the last thing that you want the community to understand about the opportunity to participate with the Salvation Army for Abilene?
The Salvation Army has been around since the late 1800s. It's been here since the early 1900s in the city of Abilene. And we are caretakers of our own little piece of a international legacy that is the Salvation Army. And to me, I find that to be a great honor to be a part of being a good steward of those resources and of the Salvation Army brand and name and be able to do the level of good that we can do for our community. So, you know, we appreciate the city of Abilene, how they gather around us, how they work with us throughout the community with all of our programs. Thanksgiving Meal was a successful event. We fed several hundreds of people during our Thanksgiving meal. We had donors like Aldersgate Church, United Supermarket, Sharon's Barbecue, The Shed, and a couple other barbecue joints around our neighborhood smoked some turkeys for us for that Thanksgiving meal. So I feel like we do an outstanding job of taking care of the legacy that is the Salvation Army that's been going since the late 1800s. And so I encourage anyone that has time to volunteer, especially during the holiday season, whether it's your time, whether it's money, or just stopping by and dropping off, you know, blankets or jackets or toys or whatever the case may be. It doesn't matter. If you got 1 hour or $1, every little bit helps the Salvation Army achieve those goals. And we're just a vehicle of the city of Abilene to help do that for our neighbors in need.
Well, thank you so much for the care you take for this community and all you do at this time of year.
Thank you. Thank you for that acknowledgement.
Well, Andre Gwynn is the development manager for the Salvation Army here in Abilene. If you want to find out more about how you can participate in these opportunities to give to this community, check them out online, salvationarmy.org/Abilene. This is the West Texas Dispatch. With more than 4 million Texans enrolled, the Lone Star State has the third highest number of Medicare beneficiaries in the U.S. Open enrollment is underway. It ends next Sunday. Medicare serves nearly 5 million Texans, and it can be a challenging process to get signed up for the right coverage. We've invited Megan Amesqua from the West Central Texas Area Agency on Aging to come in and give us some advice. Megan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, what happens during open enrollment? What are the beneficiaries deciding during this time?
So they are deciding between a prescription drug plan. So they're already automatically enrolled in Part A, their hospital insurance, and then Part B they're supposed to sign up for when they turn 65, which that's their medical insurance. Part D is the prescription drug coverage, so you're usually doing plan comparisons for those prescription drug coverage plans. There's also Medicare Advantage plans. They have the option to choose between those as well.
So I have parents who are enrolled in Medicare, and they say they're getting dozens of calls every day from folks trying to get them to enroll in something or other. What is the baseline advice that you have for seniors, people who are 65 and over that qualify for Medicare and are being inundated?
Yes, I definitely recommend to be careful about what information that they're giving out over the phone. I always tell clients that Medicare is never going to call you directly. They already have your information all in the system. So if they're asking you for your Medicare number, likely that's a Medicare Advantage plan trying to get you to sign up for a new Medicare Advantage plan. I also like to advise clients to be careful about answering those phone calls because Medicare Advantage plans likely are trying to get you to sign up for one of their plans. And if you say yes to something, half the time they're going to take that yes as, yes, I want to enroll in this plan. We've seen that come into our office many times. They ask us, I never signed up for this Medicare Advantage plan. And then turns out they answered a phone call and they said yes. If that ever does happen, you can call our office. You have 2 months to switch back to original Medicare. So that's not the end of all, but it is something to look out for because they are trying to get you to sign up for their plans because they're private insurance companies.
Is Medicare Advantage just for specific types of Medicare recipients? Is that something that everybody should consider? Is it really unique to a situation?
Not necessarily. It's kind of unique based on the plans. There's many different companies that they come from. Basically, what I like to advise clients is if you're healthy, maybe a Medicare Advantage plan would be good for you. But if you have a lot of health problems, likely the Medicare Advantage plan is going to hold you back because they like to have pre-approval. you can't get those referrals as easy. It just really holds you back. And then there's no telling what those costs are going to be. With original Medicare, they cover 80%, and you're required the 20%. And then you have the option, of course, for supplemental plans to cover that 20% as well. You don't have that option with Medicare Advantage.
So a supplemental plan is different from Medicare Advantage.
Yes. A lot of people confuse those two. So supplemental plans are only for original Medicare to cover that 20% that you're required. They're called Medigap plans sometimes, so that can get confusing sometimes. But with Medicare Advantage, they like to call themselves supplemental plans, but they're not. Medicare Advantage really is Part A, the hospital insurance, Part B, the medical insurance, and sometimes Part D, the prescription drug coverage. Sometimes they don't include that. And if they don't include that, sometimes seniors get confused too, and then they end up having a penalty for not having drug coverage. So they like to call themselves supplemental plans because sometimes they'll have discount cards. People see commercials about that all the time. But really, they're not a supplemental plan. It's just a private insurance company plan.
And so this is also the time that people would be signing up for supplemental plans?
Yes. There is an enrollment period called the Medicare Advantage Open Enrollment, and that's January 1st through March 31st. But that's you can only look at those Medicare Advantage plans. You do have the option to switch back to original Medicare if you're unhappy with your plan during that time as well.
And I understand that low-income seniors do qualify for subsidies for their Medicare coverage.
Yes.
So how do they know if that's something that they should be pursuing during this time?
They can look up that information on Medicare.gov. It's a great resource. I always recommend people to go on there. You can type in your questions. It'll pop right up. But they can also call our office. We screen every single client for those programs. There's one. It's called the Medicare Savings Program. It helps with that Part B premium, the $185 that seniors pay every month. And then we also screen them for the extra help or the low income subsidy program through Social Security that helps with the prescription drug costs as well and the premiums.
And what if you are a person that has older parents or maybe an aunt or even a grandparent that is trying to get signed up? Is there specific advice that you have for family members or loved ones? How can they be supportive?
They can always call our office. We do have to have verbal authorization, of course, but sometimes it gets so confusing that you just need an outside party to explain. Our office is non-biased. We're not going to try to get you to sign up for any certain plans. We look at what's the cheapest option, which pharmacy they want to go to. And we can do benefit explanations for every part of Medicare. The only thing we can't do is the plan comparisons for those Medigap plans. But another thing would just be to read up on Medicare.gov, maybe watch some videos.
And I know there are changes every year. This year it looks like some deductibles are going up and some other costs are going up. What are the main things that you think people should be aware of as they consider their options this time around?
I definitely recommend, even if clients are wanting to stick with the plan that they've had for years, a lot of plans I've noticed this year are going away. So if they're not going to exist in 2026, Medicare will automatically sign them up for a different drug plan. And they legally have to tell them through the mail, but some people don't check their mail every day. So I definitely recommend to log into Medicare.gov, just double check to make sure that the plan is actually going to be what you want for the next year. And then it doesn't hurt to do a plan comparison yourself. You're able to do that on Medicare.gov as well. And just see what the cheapest option is for you with all your prescriptions in there, what your preferred pharmacy is. And then as far as the premiums going up, there's not much we can do. There are those programs, like I listed before, the Medicare Savings Program and the Low Income Subsidy Program, and that's pretty much it that's out there right now.
What are the basic qualifications to get enrolled with those subsidy programs?
There's an income threshold. There's different tiers to that. I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head right now, but if you look on Medicare.gov, it will list those for you. On Medicare, the Medicare Savings Program, there's the QMB level, the QI1, SLMB, and then also a working level as well. So it varies.
Any last
tips or pieces of recommendations?
A few. The biggest advice I have for people is there's been a lot of fraud going around, which has been a common issue over the years as well. But I always tell people to check their Medicare summary notices. They are just like an explanation of benefits for any other insurance company. Most people don't look at those just because you go to the doctor, you pay, and that's it. But I would recommend to double check because there have been a lot of cases where people are seeing durable medical equipment or wound care stuff on there, and they didn't get that done. So if you ever see fraud on there, please contact the Texas Senior Medicare Patrol. They can walk you through the correct steps on how to get that fraud taken care of. They take log of everything, and then they report it to the proper people.
Well, Megan Amezcua, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you so much for having me.
Megan Amezcua is the program manager for the Area Agency on Aging with the West Central Texas Council of Governments. The enrollment window for Medicare closes this Sunday, December 7th, and you can find more information on their website, wctcog.org/area-aging. This is the West Texas Dispatch. I'm Heather Claiborne, in for George Levesque. Sarah Curtis's new biographical memoir, Daughter of a Song, details the life and career of her father, West Texas musician Sonny Curtis, as well as her relationship with him. From Meta, Texas, to Los Angeles, to Nashville, Sarah Curtis explores her father's world and the impact that had on her family. KTTZ reporter Samantha Larned sat down with her to discuss the book.
Hi, I'm Sarah Curtis. I am the author of Daughter of a Song, which is a biographical memoir. I wrote about my father, the musician Sonny Curtis, who grew up in West Texas and sadly passed away on September 19th. I began researching it in 2015 after my dad was diagnosed with stage 3 cancer. I really wanted to preserve his story and his memories. All in all, it took me about 9 years to finish the book. I'm glad that I didn't know how long it would take before I embarked on it, or I might not have started it.
When you decided to write your father's story, where did you find yourself looking for him?
You know, I looked to his songs. Even though we were very close, he was always kind of a mystery to me. He was a West Texan to his core, and he grew up in a time and a place where you didn't really express your feelings aloud. I think he expressed his feelings in many ways through his art and his music. I called him constantly for years to ask him little trivial questions, the geography of his life, the places and the cultures that shaped him. So starting with, well, he was born in 1937, but the 1950s, birth of rock and roll in West Texas, then later in LA during the California hippie movement, early 1960s through the 70s, and then on to Nashville, where he and my mother raised me.
You grew up at an intersection of so many mythologies, the South, the West, the mythology of the artist. Tell me a little bit about the process of trying to understand those things and the impact they've had on you.
As a culture, we tend to take mythologies for granted and see them as these natural things when really they're man-made. You touched on some of the mythologies that I look at in the book, such as Texas gun culture, the back to the land era of the 70s.
You talk a lot about the shadows that Buddy Holly and his death and Waylon Jennings and his life cast upon your family. How do you reckon living under a shadow with understanding the person who casts it?
My dad, it was hard to separate his career from the long shadow that Buddy Holly left. I mean, even, you know, in his obituaries, Buddy Holly was usually mentioned within the first few sentences. To complicate things, some of those giants that cast these shadows like Waylon Jennings drop by the house every once in a while. But in terms of Buddy, he died well before I was born, and I knew him as a distant, iconic figure, a voice on the radio. So I spent a lot of years reckoning with who he really was as a young man, what he meant to my father, the significance that his death played in my father's psyche. And of course, I grew up under the shadow of my dad, as well as these secondhand shadows of these great male artists. So this book became my attempt in some ways to separate myself from that shadow and make my own art outside of it.
Would you be willing to talk a little bit about how the past few months have been?
As you know, my dad sadly passed away from complications from pneumonia. It was a sudden death. He was healthy up until the end. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. It's been incredibly hard. To add to the difficulty, he died less than 2 weeks before the book came out in print. But he did get to read the book in its entirety. He got the final pass on it before I sent it off to Texas Tech University Press. Also, I was flipping through the book one day and just skimming the first chapter where I sort of articulate my motivating question for writing the book. And it's when my dad was diagnosed with cancer. And I say to him, "Dad, you can't die until I've written about you." And I had completely forgotten about that line. And when I read it, it just struck me like a lightning bolt because I thought, oh my gosh, that's exactly what he did. He fulfilled my final wish. I don't think that's an accident, and it brings me a lot of peace. And I think he was proud of it, and I think he was proud of me. So I hope I make him proud. He was never a man that you would say, "Sonny says no notes." There were always notes.
How do you feel about coming back to Lubbock? Do you remember the last time you were here?
Yes, it was in 2017, which is the visit I write about in the chapter, The Ghosts of Lubbock. Some of my earliest memories are in Meadow, Texas, outside of Lubbock, which I think the residents actually pronounce it Meta. Mom always said, my dad told her he was from Meta, Texas. And the first time she came to town, she said, "Sonny, you're from Meadow, not Meta." But hey, if it was Meta to my dad, it's Meta to me. You know, I'm not going to lie. It feels strange to be returning to Lubbock without my dad. He loved Lubbock. He thought it was the most beautiful place in the world, which my mom and I used to tease him about. He just loved the vast horizon and the flat plains and the big sky. So yeah, Lubbock is very, very special to me. And returning there feels like a lovely way to honor my dad.
You can hear more from the conversation with Sarah Curtis on KTT's website at radio.ktz.org. Daughter of a Song is available for purchase now. While we're checking in on our friends in Lubbock, it's been nearly 30 years since Texas Tech joined the Big 12 Football Conference. The Red Raiders will make their first ever appearance in the Big 12 Football Championship this weekend. As KTTZ's Bishop Van Buren reports, they'll face a familiar foe, BYU, on Saturday.
The Red Raiders will play Brigham Young University for the second time this season on Saturday, this time in Arlington at AT&T Stadium with a conference title and likely a berth in the 12-team college football playoffs on the line. Both teams have yet to appear in the Big 12 championship before. BYU joined the conference in 2023, while Tech is one of only two founding members from the league start in 1996 that had yet to reach the title game. During their first matchup in early November, Texas Tech was ranked number 8 in the nation, and BYU was one slot ahead at number 7. Tech went on to defeat BYU handily by a score of 29-7, giving the Cougars their sole loss so far this season. Tech now ranks 5th in the country, while BYU has fallen to number 11. A win on Saturday for the Red Raiders almost assuredly seals a first-round bye in the college football playoffs. I'm Bishop Van Buren in Lubbock.
It's time for West Texas Roots. This week, we hear what makes Abilene the storybook capital of America. Julie Teal, Director of Exhibitions and Collections, tells us how the National Center for Children's Illustrated Literature keeps the magic of reading alive for kids.
So in the early to mid-1990s, a group of people who were associated with cultural arts organizations in Abilene got together and started doing some studies into the feasibility of a museum for Abilene, in addition to the Grace Museum. And had already started those conversations when, in about 1996, our mayor at the time, Gary McCaleb, was reading to a group of school children in a local elementary school, and a librarian handed him the book Santa Claus by William Joyce. And he opened it, and on the first page, it said that the character Art Atchison Amesworth was from Abilene, Texas. And he thought that was so cool that he got a hold of the contact information for the book's author, William Joyce, called him up. William Joyce didn't believe it at first. He thought his friends were playing a prank on him, that the mayor of Abilene was calling him. But the two of them just became really good friends. They started to have conversations about children's literature and illustration and how it's really important that we value it. And McCaleb just really felt that it was necessary for there to be a museum dedicated to picture book illustration, especially because when talking to William Joyce, he learned that often when they're done and they've published these books, that art just kind of goes into a box under their bed. It's not really getting out in front of people in the public where it can be seen. And so from that conversation, the Nickel was born. And so we moved around from a few different locations. We were at the Grace Museum for a little while. We were at the Civic Center for some of our exhibitions. And then in 2000, we moved into this newly renovated building. So in, again, also the 90s, I believe, we had the sculpture Childhood's First Adventure, which was based on an illustration from Santa Claus. That was built and it was installed in the park across the street from the Nickel where we are now. And that sort of sparked the ongoing project of children's literature storybook sculptures in downtown Abilene that's all been spearheaded by the Cultural Affairs Council. So they are the ones who manage the storybook garden. They put together the CAF Festival every year. And so the combination of them with the work that the Nickel is doing, I think, is what led to our designation as storybook capital. So the Nickel is the National Center for Children's Illustrated Literature, and at the time that it was formed in 97, it was the first full-scale museum dedicated to children's picture book art in the U.S. There were a couple that had popped up in Eastern Asia, but at the time, all of the other, like, collections were mostly within archives, and so the Nickel was really the first of its kind. It was pioneering a new interest in museums. And we are all about honoring the work that goes into picture books, honoring it as an art form that is worthy of critical study and of exhibition and sharing with people. Because as William Joyce himself will tell you, picture book art is the first art that children are exposed to. And so it should be really good. And when it's really good, it should be honored and given that status. So we do that primarily through exhibitions and programming. Our exhibitions, we have about 3 exhibitions per year that we work with, typically with one artist at a time, although we've had some cumulative exhibitions. And that those are usually like a retrospective of that artist's career. So currently on view, we have Juana Martinez Neal's exhibition, Threads of Origin, and that pays a lot of homage to her inspirations, her influences in her cultural background as an indigenous South American woman, and sort of tracks her progression through her career. And then our programming is a combination of school tours and public programming. So all of our school tours are free. That's a really big part of the Nickel's mission, is making art accessible. Our admission is also always free. And so those school tours, there's no cost to the children or to their schools when they come in. And that's just another way to get them really thinking about the books they're reading and get them excited about both reading and about making art. And then our public programming, again, we try to keep it very accessible, so free or very low cost. We do free art events every Saturday. We do fun events like the Dog Man event that we just had, which was super fun. We gave out free books sponsored by Scholastic and by the author. And so really, it's just all about getting books and art in the hands of kids and families.
Julie Teal shared her story at the Nickel Gallery in downtown Abilene. This is the West Texas Dispatch. It's time for Conductor's Notes with the Abilene Philharmonic. This week, Greg Strawn speaks with conductor David Itkin about the annual Christmas concert, which the Philharmonic will perform this Saturday, December 6th.
David, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, as the holidays approach, nothing gets our audience in the need for the festivities more than the annual Christmas Pops concert. I'm really excited about what you've planned for this year. For folks who were listening to classical music in the 1990s, like me, it was hard to escape the phenomenon that was the three tenors featuring José Carreras, Plácido Domingo, and Luciano Pavarotti. I'm pretty sure I still have my copy of that, multi-million selling CD. What have you planned for the three tenors concert this year?
Well, picking up on the concerts that those three great men sang all over the world, and they did sing some holiday programs.
True.
And in fact, they made a holiday CD. So taking not necessarily all that music, but taking the idea of three tenors. Incredible tenors singing holiday music, both as individuals and as a group, we picked up on that idea and hired three incredible people. Dominic Chenis from the Metropolitan Opera in New York, as among other places, Arnold Rawls, also from the Met, and our own Sam Cooke, who has also sung at the Met, by the way, and Mellas, as well as many other places in the world.
Sure.
So these three incredible, diverse, and unique voices, all of them just world-class singers, are going to be joining us for this program of holiday favorites, both of the traditional type, of the more popular type. And then, of course, speaking of spoiler alerts, if you have been a fan of the three tenors and you've seen their concerts, you know that there was a very non-holiday thing. We're not going to say the words.
Fair enough.
Which always ended their concerts.
Great.
And it is at least possible that our concert will end the same way.
Oh, that'll be a Christmas gift that I think that we can all look forward to.
It may not be Christmas music, but it will be a gift.
That'll be great. So I think you're doing some of the orchestral arrangements for this concert. That's right. Is there something that you particularly enjoy doing about arrangements as your music director role for the Philharmonic?
Oh, I do, because I love crafting unique things as I craft them for these three exact singers. And we should mention that the Abilene High School Choir is going to join us for this. About three or four of the pieces near the end of the program, they join us to sing with these distinguished gentlemen as well. So we're excited to have them join us.
That'll be great.
It's going to be terrific, including on the last piece we have not named.
Fantastic.
They're going to sing. I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is I wrote an arrangement of the famous Do You Hear What I Hear? For these three tenors and the choir, and that's kind of near the end of our program as well. And there's just a great deal. Pretty much any famous holiday song you can think of,
it's going to make an appearance.
And this is going to be a unique presentation with no intermission.
Oh, great.
About an hour and a quarter, an hour 20 minutes it'll be.
Okay.
We're going to do it without intermission, so we just come in and share the love and stay focused on these wonderful singers.
That'll be great. Thanks so much for being here and giving us your conductor notes. David Itkin will conduct the Abilene Philharmonic in the Christmas concert on December 6th at 7:30 p.m. at the Abilene Civic Center. You can find out more information about this performance and how to get tickets on our website, kacu.org. I'm Greg Strawn, and you're listening to Conductor's Notes with the Abilene Philharmonic on KACU.
And we leave you with some thoughts from Glenn Dromgoole.
Brevity is a virtue, to be sure, but evidently not in literature. These days, a book needs to be at least 100,000 words to be taken seriously. Well, I've written about 35 books, and if you took all my books and put them together, they probably wouldn't top 100,000 words. But then, I've not always been taken seriously either. Still, I think it's possible to be even more brief. Several writers have offered their thoughts on how to write a whole book in just 6 words. Here are a few of my ideas. For example, a book on Texas history. The Alamo, Lost Battle, Won War. A Texas travel log. Drove all day, still in Texas. A sports book. Friday night, winning touchdown, new girlfriend. A book on business. Oil boom. Made fortune. Blew it. A biography. Born. Drank. Found Jesus. Quit. Died. A mystery. Boyfriend cheated. Poisoned him. Became nun. A western. Bad guys. Stolen horses. Hanging Tree. A children's book. Once Upon a Time, The End. An academic tome. Introduction, text with footnotes, conclusion, index. And nearly every romance novel can be summed up in 6 words. Can't stand each other, become lovers. This is Glenn Dromgoole for the West Texas Dispatch.
Glenn is the writer of some 36 books and runs the Texas Star Trading Company with his wife, Carol. This has been the West Texas Dispatch. Thanks for tuning in. We're here each Wednesday at noon. If you miss an episode, you can subscribe to the podcast. West Texas Dispatch is available on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You can also find the podcast on our website and on the KACU mobile app. We had help this week from producer Jordan Herrick and our digital editor, Calvin Claiborne. George Levesque will be back in the host chair next week. I'm Heather Claiborne.